He was unbowed, but he didn't have the bearing of a king. Not even a deluded one.
So, you call yourself a king?
That's your word.
A king of the Jews, at least. The king you people have been waiting for, is that it?
When, in Luke's Gospel, Jesus is dragged before Pilate by the chief priests and scribes, he's accused of claiming to be a king. That charge, if true, would inevitably draw a swift response from Rome. Pilate did indeed have Jesus crucified in Jerusalem. But why? Who did he think Jesus was? And how did a man who Luke clearly believes was a peacemaker invite such devastating punishment upon himself? To explore this part of Luke's story, I've come to meet Professor Larry Hurtado in another royal city, Edinburgh.
So I've come up to the Mound in Edinburgh, just below the Royal Mile, looking down onto Princes Street, and I'm thinking of Edinburgh, a commercial, very bustling city, many resemblances to Jerusalem at Passover time.
Very much so. If you were here during festival time, it would be a more, even more appropriate analogy, because the population of Edinburgh almost doubles in size. And in Jerusalem during Passover season, it's estimated that it may have come close to doubling in size. So lots of foreign visitors, lots of tourists, people trying to find accommodation, bustling, streets crowded. The additional factor being that it was a temple city, and so everybody needing to perform religious duties within a certain time frame. Passover was a typical good time for somebody to cause trouble if they wanted to. So a lot of anxiety on the part of the Roman government about potential revolt and rebellion.
So when Jesus sits down to celebrate his Last Supper, he's come into Jerusalem on a donkey with crowds waving palms and shouting Hosanna. He's cleansed the temple of the money changers. So do you think the disciples would have been expecting him to take on the Romans?
Oh, I don't know that they would have expected him to take on the Romans as such. Instead, they may have been expecting divine help. They may have been expecting, if Jesus acted in a decisive way, if he was really God's man, that it would result in angels and divine powers coming down to fight on their side. I mean, the Dead Sea Scrolls predict a great war to come in the future when the decisive armies will not be human armies, but angelic armies that come to their side. So they could have been expecting something like that.
Jesus said to his disciples, "When I sent you out without a purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything?" They said, "No, not a thing." And he said to them, "But now, the one who has a purse must take it, and likewise a bag, and the one who has no sword must sell his cloak and buy one." They said, "Lord, look, here are two swords." He replied, "It is enough."
When I was a student, people were very excited about the sudden possibility that maybe Jesus was, after all, a Marxist revolutionary born out of due time.
Tom Wright is Bishop of Durham.
People quoted this bit about the sword, and nobody's quite sure how to translate that. My own view is that he means, "Oh, enough of this. You just haven't understood the first thing I'm saying." In other words, what he's trying to say to them in his usual picture language is, things are going to get very rough. Don't imagine that now we've had this splendid meal together, it's all going to be sweetness and light. It's going to be the exact opposite. Jesus is not advocating an armed struggle to further his cause. That would be the very antithesis of what he means.
But the temple police who Judas brings to find Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane are armed. They'd hardly have brought swords and clubs unless they feared that Jesus was about to instigate an uprising. And when Jesus is brought before the Jewish authorities the next morning, they ask him if he's the Messiah. What do they mean by that? Paula Gooder is canon theologian at Birmingham Cathedral.
There are lots of opinions about who the Messiah might or might not have been in the first century. But I think that what they mean by the Messiah is somebody who's going to come and drive out the Romans and save the people and make the land free and prosperous and glorious like they hoped it would always have been.
And they ask him another question. They ask him if he's the Son of God. What do they mean by that?
In Old Testament tradition, the Son of God phrase is most often used for the king. So they could be asking him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Alternatively, they could be asking a Roman question. So the person that we know who did use the phrase Son of God was Caesar Augustus. So they could be saying, are you the one who's going to challenge the Romans at the heart of the Roman system?
Now, when Jesus is asked that question, he very cleverly sidesteps it. And instead he calls himself the Son of Man. Now, what does that term mean?
It can just mean human being, but here it seems to mean something much more significant. Luke uses it in the phrase, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God, and it seems to mean something about being in the heavenly realms and about being the judge. So what Jesus seems to be saying here is, you're judging me now, but actually you will see from now on that I'm the one who's judging you.
Now, Luke clearly believes that Jesus is both Messiah and Son of God. So why does he have Jesus equivocating about accepting those terms?
Jesus seems to be uncertain about using Messiah and Son of God because it plays into people's expectations. Jesus refuses to play their game. He wants to play his own game, and that's why he refuses the titles.
It's a game the authorities don't understand. They persist in seeing Jesus as a real threat. But even his provocative behaviour in turning over the tables in the temple and predicting its destruction wouldn't have been enough to get him killed, according to Larry Hurtado.
The Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, who's writing at about the same time, by the way, as Luke Acts, tells a very interesting story of another figure named Jesus, who is pictured as going about denouncing the temple, prophesying its destruction. The temple authorities are terribly annoyed with this. They arrest him, they interrogate him, they flog him, but then they finally decide that he's sort of a harmless person. He's a, you know, an apocalyptic preacher, but ultimately harmless, doesn't have a following behind him, and they let him go for actions that are actually very, very similar to those things that some scholars think were sufficient to get Jesus crucified.
So why was Jesus killed?
Best guess, I think that he was killed because he was perceived to be a royal pretender, a royal Messiah figure, and therefore deserved exactly the not only the execution, but the degradation that is involved in crucifixion. Crucifixion isn't intended simply to kill you. The Romans have a whole arsenal of means of executing you if they want to. Crucifixion has the additional benefit from the Roman standpoint of the most total degradation and humiliation as possible. So they didn't simply want to kill Jesus, they wanted to squash him like a bug.
Every week in churches all over the world, Christians recite the Creed and recall the name of the man who took that decision to crush Jesus. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate. Helen Bond is lecturer in New Testament at Edinburgh University and author of a book on this infamous Roman governor.
We actually know quite a lot about Pilate. The Jewish writer Josephus tells us quite a lot of incidents that happened during his governorship, and also Philo of Alexandria, who's roughly contemporary with Pilate, and both of them paint a very harsh picture of Pilate. Philo in particular says that his governorship was one atrocious event after another. The difficulty, though, is that we have to be quite cautious in how we treat these Jewish references to Pilate. None of them liked Pilate at all, and they all have their own particular agenda. They're wanting to show him in a brutal light for a particular reason.
I'm intrigued by the fact that Luke suggests in an earlier passage that Pilate was a particularly brutal man in a way that none of the other gospel writers do.
Yes, Luke has a story about a number of Galilean pilgrims who come down to Jerusalem, presumably at Passover, and he says that Pilate mingled their own blood with the blood of their sacrifices, particularly gruesome image there, suggesting that Pilate himself was somebody who would just kill off a load of pilgrims, probably without a second's thought.
So do you think Luke is trying to paint him in a particular gory light as compared to the other gospel writers?
I think what he's wanting to do is to show that this is a mean and uncompromising Roman governor. And so the fact that he's clearly quite impressed by Jesus and says three times that he finds him innocent, really, I think, then is more striking.
Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify! Crucify him!" The third time he said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they kept urgently demanding with loud shouts that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed.
Luke's picture of Pilate is really of a weakling. he's the official Roman witness to Jesus' innocence, but he eventually has to send Jesus to the cross because in Luke's presentation of the people that he's supposed to govern, because it's the Jewish leaders and even the people themselves who clamour for crucifixion. They shout, "Away with him, crucify him." And so Pilate reluctantly has to send him to the cross.
By the time Luke was writing his gospel, 40 or 50 years after Jesus' death, the early church had spread throughout the Roman Empire. Larry Hurtado says part of Luke's agenda in writing may have been to show Rome that it had nothing to fear from this new religious movement.
Obviously, I think that the author of Luke Acts, as all the New Testament authors, are anxious to avoid any confrontation with the Roman authorities if they can. They're anxious to say, you know, we will pay our taxes, we will not try to mount a revolt, leave us alone. So they aren't anxious to go looking for trouble with the Romans.
At the same time, in Helen Bond's view, Luke also wants to allay Christian misgivings about Rome.
I think what Luke is doing is writing to a community that has quite a lot of Roman citizens within it. And what he's trying to say to them is that there's no conflict of interest between your Roman identity and your Christian identity, because Jesus was not somebody who was guilty under Roman law. He went unjustly to his death.
When we come to the end of Luke's life of Jesus, once again, he has a particular take on it, a particular spin, which is unique to him.
Richard Burridge is Dean of King's College London.
On the way to the cross, the women of Jerusalem weep for Jesus, and Jesus turns to them and says, "Look, don't weep for me, weep for yourselves, because women and children will be the first against the wall when the invading army comes in." When he's being nailed to the cross, he prays forgiveness for the poor soldiers and the carpenter who has to nail this carpenter to a piece of wood. On the cross, he is concerned for the penitent thief. And then he ends not with the cry of being forsaken, as in Mark, but with this humble prayer of, "Father, into your hand I commit my spirit." And so what Luke is saying is that this man dies as he lives, caring for women, caring for children, caring for the humble poor, the ordinary working man, even bringing the thieves into paradise, and with a night psalm of prayer and commitment to his Heavenly Father on his lips.
It's a masterpiece of composition. And Luke's purpose in telling it is to convey that what happened at a place appropriately called the Skull, however terrible, was somehow part of God's plan for Israel and for the world. In Radio 4's drama, Witness Tomorrow, Jesus' mother, Mary, looks back on the events surrounding his birth. And when I go behind Luke's story, I'll find out how Luke's great epic draws together the beginning and end of the life of Jesus.